Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE, 91.5 FM and on HD in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the Global Irish since our founding in 1993. We are coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had another good week, and I hope that the heat of New York City and the humidity is not too much for you all. It's nice to be coming to you today from a cool, air-conditioned 1 Washington Mews, and in this kind of weather during this season, we wonder how New Yorkers of the past managed in a city where getting cool really involved hopping on a train out to Rockaway Beach or something like that. So I often think of the New Yorkers of the past, as I said, in the month of July. Enough about the weather anyway. On today's show, I am delighted to share with you a recent interview I undertook with someone who is new to the role of, there was a new appointment made as Minister for State of the Diaspora, Jimmy Deanahan, who was the past Minister for Arts, Heritage and the Gaeltacht. Jimmy Deanahan is no stranger to New York City, not only through his political works and his interactions, but in his early history, he came here as a footballer and has long ties with the Kerry diaspora and indeed Irish America more generally here through New York and indeed more generally across the United States. So folks, I hope you'll enjoy my chat with Minister for Diaspora, Jimmy Deanahan, TD. And on the theme of thinking about 2016, I'm also going to share with you this week the audio for our first of a series of videos that we are releasing to mark and explain to people what we're doing for fall 2015 and into spring 2016 in terms of commemorating the Easter Rising. So I'll share the audio with you. For any of you who are interested, please go to our website where you'll be able to view the video in full and find out further information of what we have in store starting with gusto in September of this year. So I hope you will enjoy that too, folks. I'm here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU with someone who is no stranger to Ireland House, to Glucksman Ireland House, or to New York. In fact, our first Minister for the Diaspora, Jimmy Deanahan. For people outside of Ireland, I think it was a really wonderful development to see formally a portfolio assigned to the diaspora. I think this is your first time at Glucksman Ireland House wearing this hat, Minister Deanahan, is that correct?
Well, it is. Yeah. I've been here before to meet Loretto and to meet Jolie. But it's my first time here as Minister for the Diaspora, so I'm delighted to be here and also to recognise as well the very important and critical role that Glucksman House plays in the archiving, I suppose, of material on the diaspora here in New York and indeed USA. So I'm delighted to be here, and Glucksman House certainly is very much part of the international diaspora infrastructure that's very, very important, especially in storing the stories and the history of so many different ways of Irish immigration here to New York over the years. So I'm delighted to be here, and I'm a very good friend of Joe Lee's as well. And you know, Joe has a huge connection with my county, Kerry, and he's a very respected historian in Ireland, one of those historians that's very well balanced on his view of history. And certainly people read Joe, I would think, to get the real story.
So for some of our listeners, Minister, who may not be familiar with your background, would you mind telling us your connection with New York goes back over decades? Can you tell us a little bit about your connections to the place?
It does, and I must say, every time I come here, it's like the first time. It's as exciting as that introduction you get to New York, get to Manhattan when you came here first. So I came here first in 1973. I came here playing football to Gaelic Park. I was a student, and John Kerry O'Donnell brought me over. John Kerry was a huge figure here in New York. It was John Kerry's initiative that established Gaelic Park about 1946. And Gaelic Park played a very significant role not only in promoting Gaelic football in New York, but also from a social aspect as well. There are several people here in New York that wouldn't be here only for Gaelic Park, because that's where their parents met. It was a great center for people meeting each other and for just, I suppose, interacting with each other, and for various families and counties coming together. John Kerry was, in a way, a controversial figure as well in New York. He wasn't universally popular, but I must say that he was an extraordinary figure for his time, and of course he lived until well into his 90s, and he was still involved in Gaelic Park right up to the end of his life. So he was an extraordinary figure in his own way, but it was John Kerry who brought me first. And
so where were you studying, Minister? In Cork?
I was studying in Limerick. It was the National College of Physical Education, and it was on the same campus as the National Institute of Higher Education, and both of them came together then to form University of Limerick. Mm-hmm. It's a spectacular campus actually, and it's one of the great universities in Ireland. It was into technology and to the computer era before any other university in Ireland. Whereas the rest of them were still focusing on the humanities and law and medicine, Limerick was into the whole ICT age and produced some of the leaders now in that industry in Ireland, and actually I meet them all over the world. So it was way of his time. There was an individual there, Ed Welsh, who was young at that particular time and made huge contacts all over the world, and indeed Loretta made a huge contribution there, and also Chuck Feeney made a huge contribution, and now the Ryan family are making a huge contribution financially and otherwise. So they were very good too at connecting in, I suppose, the people that philanthropists who could help them. So I was going at that particular time, so I remember well, I'd be doing a practical in athletics or something, and I'd be collected by the great Mico Dwyer, who later became my manager in the Kerry team, and I'd head to Shannon and get on a flight and be in New York on Saturday and maybe play golf or something on a Saturday, and then play a match on Sunday and go back Sunday night and be in a class Monday morning, because no one believed me that I was doing this to New York until I started bringing back things like pink putters you couldn't get them in Ireland, or some really nice tops from Macy's or whatever. So it was a very exciting time for me, and it was back in that period of time when I was very young, I suppose, adventurous, and coming to Manhattan, which was then the nerve center of the world and still is, was a great experience for somebody from rural Ireland. I must say as well that it's a very Irish part of America, Manhattan. It's a place where it's popular to be Irish. Being Irish, I think, open doors to you, certainly here in Manhattan. And there's a huge Irish connection in business as well, in whatever level, be it the stock exchange with people like Dennis Kelleher, who's a Kerry man, who's been there for years, be it in the whole, I suppose, pub business. You have so many Irish bars here, very highly quality people. Like Mick Carty has been here for years, still is, with Rosie O'Grady's and so many more. And then people in the legal profession as well, people like Brian O'Dwyer, he's been here for years as well, the O'Dwyer family, and his uncle was mayor of New York. And there's this huge connection with Ireland, and we are a small population, but we are very significant influence in America, and especially here in Manhattan and New York. It's something that we should recognize and not take for granted, but it's very important. It's like the greater Ireland, as it often has been described beyond, but it certainly is. And it's extraordinary too how people have brought the respect for Irish culture with them, for the language, for the music, for song and dance, and also for the Gaelic Games, and at the same time becoming obviously very American as well, and being very proud of being American, but always remembering where they came from, and using, I would say, that background actually to be better Americans, in that sense. So that relationship, and we could be here, we could do a whole day's program on that, has been very important for me. I've been to New York, I would say, more times than any other city in the world, apart from Dublin. And as I say, I've never had one bad experience in New York. I've never met one person that I didn't get on with in New York, and it has been all very positive. And in my present position as Minister for the Diaspora, obviously that experience I've had here in New York has really helped me understand people. You have to accept differences of opinion, be it political or otherwise, difference even in county rivalries, but overarching all of that is that just sense of connectivity with Ireland that's really very strong and very, very important. And as I said, Luxman House here plays a critical role in, giving coordination to that kind of cultural heritage response to that relationship. That's really very important and very critical.
Can I ask you, Minister, just, I know we want to talk about other things, but when you started coming over in 1973 like that, and you were basically commuting across the Atlantic at times, that must have been fairly on, I mean, you know, air travel was still, you know, wasn't that old in the early 70s, and at least air travel that didn't take 12, 13 hours, and, you know, the old propeller flights, and, you know, stopping off in Gander and places to refuel. So I imagine, or do you know, you must have been in that very early wave of people who would be able to actually do that kind of commuting over and back, you know, like you describe.
Well, that time you had the compulsory stopover in Shannon, and everyone going to America had to go through Shannon. There wasn't even a connection with Dublin, I'd say, that time. So it was very convenient for me. I was in college in Limerick, and all I had to do was go to the airport. But you had the jumbo jets that time, mm-hmm. and it was very comfortable.
Were there other fellas who'd come out earlier than you doing the same kind of thing, do you know of?
Well, there may have been, because that traffic to America from Ireland for people coming out playing football started probably in the late 60s.
Okay. So it was still, though, relatively new.
It was new. Yeah. It was new. And
was it John Kerry O'Donnell who was behind it all?
Very much so. Very much so. And he was quite generous. I remember at that particular time, you'd get your ticket paid for and you'd get $100 to play the game. We were kind of professionals.
And you were put up somewhere?
You were put up, yeah. You were put up near Gaelic Park. There was a motel quite close to it. And you were very well looked after. So £40 that time in 73 was a lot of money, so it meant as a student I could eat steaks more than chips probably and beans and peas, so I had that edge over other people. And as an athlete, obviously I could prepare better if you could eat better in that sense. So it was really very important. And
how long did you do it for?
Well, I did it for it was for a short period, because then Kerry won the All-Ireland in 1975, and after that then we were coming to New York with Kerry. Please. Because we were winning the All-Ireland, and we wouldn't be allowed more or less come over to play club games in case we got injured. So I did it for a few years. And but of course then we were coming, we won a large number of All-Irelands that time, so we were coming to New York every year, maybe two times a year. Occasionally you'd be invited over for functions, so I kept that connection. And I remember there was a friend of mine, Sean Fleming. He was a great musician. He used to play in Flanagan's. It was well known that time, an Irish pub down in Manhattan, and that's where we used to make a beeline for at that time. And we had just great times here. Actually, we had access, some of us, to Studio 54, I think, at that particular time. So the people in Studio 54 thought us Kerry guys were huge international stars. We were up there with their estimation, with Pelly and all that. So we had some really good evenings down in Studio 54, which was very big in New York that time. But we were very much into the social scene in New York when we arrived here. We were very comfortable with it. People made very important connections, even outside of the Irish network here in Manhattan. We even went outside that to make links in the whole social scene here, which was, of course, great education. And it was a very good, I suppose, confidence developer as well. So when we then... we went around the world, we won four All-Irelands in a row, and we went to Australia and Hawaii. Because of our experience here in Manhattan and New York, we were certainly prepared for every eventuality, wherever we went. And also that time, it nurtured my interest in the arts as well, because obviously when I'd come here, if there were huge... performances going on in 42nd Street, including a great musical, 42nd Street. We went to 42nd Street, Dr. Shabago, I remember at that particular time. It was the time of Saturday Night Fever and Grease, and so many more great productions were going on Broadway at that time. And we stayed in at the Hilton in the middle of town, close to Madison Square Garden. So we... some of us that would be interested in the theatre would make a beeline for it. So that was all very important in education. You wouldn't see shows like that in Ireland, and here in New York you'd be going, if it wasn't obviously the first night, you'd be going and there'd be no problem getting in anywhere if you could buy the ticket. So that was, it was huge in that sense. And also I must say that if ever I played a match in Gaelic Park, I'd always, you know, stay around afterwards and meet some of those people. Even at that time, some of those people would have even been over there very early in the 20th century. But even I met a few people that had gone over even in the late 19th century, even at that time. Some very old people.
Very old, wow.
Very old, yeah. And it was very interesting just to listen to their stories. And I remember at that time... suggesting to the media back at home, if there were media people with us that were out just looking for stories from the footballers, or maybe if people were doing, if they did something wrong or whatever, or if there were any issues about playing or controversy. And I often remember telling reporters, both from the print media and the broadcasting media, that they should go away and interview the guys who were at the game rather than maybe the people who were playing the game, because they would have got great stories from people. But unfortunately there was no, I think, understanding of the amount of connection
and history between, that people were walking around with in their heads and their experience.
That was it, and there was a huge opportunity left there, because these people came to Gaelic Park Sunday after Sunday. I was up there playing club games, and you might have up to 5,000 people there, because there was a huge population, obviously, of Irish-born people in New York at that time. That has dwindled because, as you know, of the 1967 Act, where it's changed from the quota system, as people know very well here, to family reunification. And so you don't have that legal now pathway for Irish people to get to America, except with J-1 visas or maybe work visas or investment visas. But it's not as easy for people to come anymore, which is very unfortunate. And that's the challenge for the future. If we want to keep that link between Ireland and America, which is a very real one, it's a very deep one, it's historical. Irish people generally are very supportive of the USA. They recognize what the US have done for Ireland. And in order to maintain that link, I think it's very important that there's some legal pathway that if Irish people want to come to America for a short time or spend their lives here, that is available to them. And it's not at this moment of time. So when I meet the likes of Paul Ryan or some of the other influential people on Capitol Hill, I explain that to them. Paul Ryan, for example, now I suppose one of, with Peter King, the most influential of Irish Republicans, who is very, I must say, connected and really respectful of his Irish connections. The first thing you see in his office in Capitol Hill is a holly, because he's from Kilkenny, obviously. But I just feel that our connections within the Republican Party at this moment in time, because they're in control of both houses, the Senate and Congress, that they must realize the effects that dwindling immigration from Ireland will have on that relationship between Ireland and America in the future. That should be a consideration. At the same time, I realize that we're just one country of many that's looking for kind of different conditions, I suppose, regarding immigration and the numbers coming to America. But I think that we do have a special relationship with America that should be recognized. And as a country, if we had a quota maybe of 10,000 people, that's as much as we would need. Mm-hmm. And also not just at the highly skilled level, but the semi-skilled level as well, because typically in the past, actually, a large number of people that came from Ireland were people that came here as domestics, as bartenders, as building workers, labourers, and so on. And there is that cadre of people that would still like to come to America and would make a major contribution here in those jobs if they were given the opportunity. So it's a huge issue, mm-hmm. but going back to that connection between, say, myself personally and New York, I can just see that it has been a very important connection for me personally, but that whole Irish connection with New York, where at one stage I think a quarter of the population of New York was actually born in Ireland, going back to the gangs of New York at that time where they were Irish speaking, some of them couldn't speak English even. So that's very important. And from, I suppose, an educational point of view and from a historian's point of view, that connection is very important and has been analysed by several historians over the years. And I think even now it's more relevant than ever, that aspect of that connection.
Minister, if I could just ask you, you touched on their kind of county rivalries a little bit earlier, and as someone now, you know, earlier in your career, you were travelling, you know, under the auspices of, you know, connections to Kerry football and things like that. But, you know, in your more recent, you know, in the more recent part of your career in politics and, you know, as Minister for the Arts, Heritage and Gaelic Affairs, and now you're as Minister for the Diaspora, would you, like, I noticed very strongly that in the Irish diaspora that there's something different about Kerry people and the connections between Kerry and her diaspora that is slightly different than all of the other 31 counties of Ireland. Do you, I mean, is that too hard a question to ask you as a Kerry man who travels abroad? I see it, I mean, and it fits into the literature, the scholarship that says the further a place is, a region is from the capital, from the metropole, i.e. Dublin in our case, the stronger the local identities tend to be. You know, that's what the general scholarship says, not just about Ireland, but about different places. And I think of Kerry when I think of that analogy, because it isn't, I don't know actually in miles if Donegal or other counties are further, but there is something about the connection of Kerry people in terms of how they come together, even across the diaspora. You don't seem to have the divide that you sometimes have between the emigrant and the people in Ireland. Would you have noticed that?
Well, I've been working, obviously, because of football with the Kerry diaspora for years. Mm-hmm. Even before 73, there wasn't a PE college in Ireland when I did my Leaving Cert.
That's physical education.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I went to London for a year and a half before the college was open in Limerick. So I played with Kerry Club in London, and obviously then I was directly connected in to the Kerry diaspora in London, which mostly was made up of people who were working in building sites. Mm-hmm. They were referred to as navvies. Some people don't like that term, but that generally they were referred to as navvies, some of them. Great people, and I played a number of games with them in the London Senior League and Championship, and I built up a very good understanding too of the challenges that they faced in London. And I suppose when it came to Friday evening, they got their wages, and some of them spent them in the Crown Pub in Cricklewood and in Kilburn High Road, and they didn't make much provision for the future, unfortunately for them. Though they gave me just a great appreciation and respect for these people. A lot of them would send half their earnings home, and then probably drink the other half for, you know, when they'd have paid for their accommodation. They shared lodgings with people, shared beds with people, and they made a huge commitment to Ireland through remittances and so on. They helped educate their nieces and nephews at home, and even put bathrooms and sanitary conditions into houses. At that time, a lot of houses in Ireland didn't have water in the bathrooms, and these people did it. And unfortunately, as it moved on a few generations, people didn't remember that for some of them. And when they came back to Ireland then in their old age, when they were looking for maybe help or some form of support, it wasn't always forthcoming. So that's why, so the Department of Foreign Affairs, they operate an immigrant support program, and we provide money, as I'm now the minister and I'm in charge of this program, for immigrant support centres in UK, here in New York, where you have the Irish Centre, in Queens, you have the Ashling Centre, you have the Emerald Isle Centre. We provide substantial funding for those centres, so that those centres then can provide services for that, I suppose, demographic of Irish people that came here to work in building sites and so on, that may have lost their partners, that may have addiction issues, mental health issues, and that could be just very isolated. So we provide money to those centres so that they can reach out and identify who those people are, and if those people want services then, or advice or comfort or support, that they would provide it. Mm-hmm. And it's as really a response to their, I suppose, support for Ireland during 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, when we were a very poor country.
So we're kind of giving back that way through
we're
the
just
government.
It's an opportunity to give back. But certainly that connection between Ireland and its diaspora, and you go back to the counties, very strong. And I was working anyway on that connection long before I got this job. As far away as the Silicon Valley, actually, I twinned Listowel and San and Los Gatos back in 1994. The former mayor of San Jose was a man called Tom McHenry. Tom was mayor of San Jose during this very formative period from 82 to 90, so he invited me to go there. And Dublin is twinned with San Jose, and it has worked out very well for Dublin. Dublin has got a huge level of investment from the Silicon Valley, and having Dublin twinned with San Jose has been very important, because some of these chief executives, when they were looking at Dublin, they'd see straight away, well, we're twinned with Dublin from San Jose. And Los Gatos, then it's a little town outside San Jose, twinned with Listowel, and that has been very successful from a cultural point of view, from a tourism point of view, an artistic point of view. But unfortunately, we didn't get any industries to set up in Listowel. Silicon Valley industries generally have set up in Dublin, mostly. So I've been working on that networking, and that's why probably the Taoiseach appointed me Minister for the Diaspora. There's probably nobody else in the Dáil with that kind of connection over such a long period of time. And but all I would say, and I'm saying this to other counties, I'm Minister for Diaspora for all of the country, obviously, and that includes Northern Ireland as well, because I'm meeting an awful lot of people from the six counties of Northern Ireland, and they feel, even from both divisions, from both sides of the nationalist and unionist side, when they leave Ireland, they're Irish. They were born on the 30 on Ireland, so they're Irish. Apart from the political boundary, the geographical boundary is not there. They're on the island of Ireland. So I meet these people from both sides of the community, and actually I just see a major opportunity of improving understanding between both sides of the Northern Divide through the whole diaspora ministry. And I've seen that working already. Now, one thing that I have developed in Kerry is a global Kerry network, and I've been at this ever before I got this job, and it's a very effective network that we have built up, myself and this other girl. She works with KPMG in Dublin, Keelan Cassan, and we have built up this network through LinkedIn, 300 Kerry business people, different parts of the world. So now we are cooperating with the local authority. There are local enterprise offices, and the local enterprise office that's administered by Kerry County Council will have a dedicated officer to link with its diaspora. So we are using LinkedIn and Connect Ireland, and Connect Ireland was set up to try to make connections all over the world between Irish people and the whole business community. There are 50,000 connectors at the moment. If you come through Dublin Airport, Connect Ireland is advertising, looking for connectors. So, and then if you can get jobs that can be verified, validated, then you get a reward of $1,500. And people can either take that, or they can give it to charity of their choice or whatever. And that has worked quite well in the last 2 years. It has produced 1,000 jobs, many of them coming from America. So instead of 140 people working in our Industrial Development Authority, and they have been very successful in getting foreign direct investment into Ireland, we have 50,000 out there now looking for opportunities for Ireland, and it's working quite well. So there's a global Irish network that was formed in 2009, and that comprises of 350 people, and they have organized 3 global economic forums that proposals like Connect Ireland and other proposals came from. And this year, for example, is the Irish Year of Design, and there'll be an event, maybe 2 events here in this city. We built this city as one of them that would be very focused on building Manhattan and building New York, and also hopefully that we'll have some Irish designers over for New York Fashion Week. But there's a whole layer of people then, like last night I was up at the Kerry function, the Kerry major fundraising initiative for the Centre of Excellence in Kerry, and people like Maurice Regan and Donal O'Sullivan of Navilis. JP Morgan is one of the big companies here in New York. Maurice Regan as president of that, and Donal O'Sullivan, Navalis, they built Ground Zero, very, very progressive company employing a large number of people. So them are on the Global Irish network. So each county, Kerry, they're on now the Kerry Global Network. So each county have people like Maurice Regan and Donal O'Sullivan. So what I'm saying to each county, you just work in the Kerry model. The structures are there already, so you reach out and you form that network around every county if they do. Then you don't lose out on anyone that's out there, because there's that connection to place, and the likelihood is that local councillors or the officials will be able to identify people who are upwardly mobile, who are doing well in business, that could help their counties. So I'm using the Kerry model in my own experience to promote that around the country, and hopefully they will take it on. We are going to provide a toolkit for them. We're having a seminar shortly just to explain how important it could be, and I'm convinced that this will work because of my experience in the past, that you need to be very professional how you treat a network. Then there's the whole issue of privacy. You don't want to have a network where people are just regarded as fundraisers, or if there's a local charity, they go to this network looking for contributions. That's not how it works. It's a kind of a loose organization of individuals that are, I suppose, connected to the community, the platform that they're part of, through their affinity with maybe their townland, their place where they were born, or their county. And in Ireland, sometimes the connection with the county is even stronger than the country. Mm-hmm. And say in a place like Kerry, when you meet Kerry people around the world, they'll ask you, how will the county team do this year? That's the first question that 90% of Kerry people that I meet will ask me. How will the boys do this year? They don't even say the county team, but that's the understanding. Whereas they won't ask you how the Irish rugby team will do, the Irish soccer team, Manchester United, Liverpool. It's Kerry they think of first.
Well, that kind of goes back to my initial question, and I think in a roundabout way you've answered that.
Well,
I want to, you're being very generous with your time, and I know you have to get going soon, but can I ask you a little bit? We're in the middle almost, oh no, we are in the middle of 1915. We're looking towards, I'm sorry, we're in the middle of 2015. We're looking towards 2016 as a big year in Ireland. From your vantage point, Minister, how do you see the year ahead of us in terms of commemorating the rising?
No, it's very exciting. And just final thing about Kerry, people are connected to the county because of its landscape, obviously, and its distinctive landscape and its culture. There's no doubt about it, and it's quite unique. And this has been interpreted for us by our artists and by our great literary giants like John McKean, Brian McMahon, Brendan Kennelly, and Tomás O'Crohan from the Blasket Islands, and Pixares and others. So that connection with Kerry, it's very linked to culture and topography of the county and landscape, as well as Gaelic football. So that makes, and language, mm-hmm. as well, the Irish language. Now, about 1916, it's very exciting. Back in 1966, actually, preparations weren't even in place by October. Now we have preparations well in place. And I was in charge of commemorations. I taught history as well for 8 years in secondary school. And I have a really deep interest in history. And I was involved in the early part of the commemorations. We had events to recognise the foundation of the Irish Volunteers. That was in November 2013, in establishing Cumann na mBan in April of 2014, and a number of other events as well. And I must say the commemorations that we had, and also of course the introduction of the Home Rule Bill, that was in April of 1912. And actually I was a bit disappointed with kind of the media treatment of the both the print and the TV media, the news media, how they treated that, because I just felt that to understand what happened afterwards in Ireland, including 1916, you really had to understand what was on offer with Home Rule, and also why the unionist resistance, and to understand why the unionist population in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, resisted Home Rule, and to understand the present even separation between both communities in Northern Ireland, which is still there. At least now they're not shooting each other. There's not a civil war on there, which there was nearly for 30 years. It was terrorism, it was civil war, it was all the wrong things, and luckily people have matured now and they'll discuss their differences in an assembly and in a chamber rather than, you know, murdering each other. That is obviously a very, very positive development at this stage. But to understand the divisions in Northern Ireland, you'd have to understand the positions that people took on Home Rule. And I just feel that there was a great opportunity to analyse that. The Irish Times did a supplement on it, but they didn't get historians to write about it. It was mostly journalists, and I think that wasn't used, and I was at pains to point out at the time that it should be made every effort possible to promote the understanding of the introduction to the Home Rule Bill. But it wasn't taken up to the extent I think it should have been, because it would have then give a greater understanding of why 1916 happened. Basically, it happened because the Westminster government did not put in place Home Rule. And in March of 1912, there was a major public meeting, assembly in O'Connor Street, perhaps the largest ever. And there were four speakers, all in favour of Home Rule. There was John Redmond, he spoke right near O'Connor's monument. There was John Dillon, his deputy. There was Padraig Pearce and Noel MacNeill. And they all spoke in favour of Home Rule. Pearce on the day spoke in Irish. He said, didn't give us everything, but it was a major development. But again, because of unionist opposition, and they had their reasons, of course, and because of the inability then of Westminster to implement Home Rule when it was eventually agreed in 1914, that's what led to 1916. Mm-hmm. It was just frustration of the lack of activity in that sense. Even John Redmond came here to New York, and he was very well received here in New York when people thought we were getting Home Rule in Ireland. It changed the course of Irish history. A lot of background work has been put in place at this stage. There's a very good program for next year. My central objective at all times was to recognise the leaders of 1916, their families, and also all those who participated in 1916. And there wasn't a large number of people, probably about 2,000 in Dublin. And nothing happened in the rest of the country because the rising was called off. There was some form of activity down in Wexford and in Escarty, low-level activity in Galway. There was a major battle in Ashburn where the great Thomas Ashe actually led a Kerryman and Richard Mulcahy. That was one encounter where actually the volunteers had success. And then the rest of it was very focused in O'Connor Street, and that was led primarily by the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which was a secret organisation, by the Citizens Army, led by James Connolly, by Cumann na mBan. They provided the services, the backup services, the food, the medical services around Dublin. There were the messengers, there were carrying the messages to the different outposts, and they were eventually, it was Nurse Farrell that took the surrender note from Pearce to General Lowe. she walked to the barricade, which she was very courageous to do so. It was about 2,000 people, and it should be possible to recognise the families of those people, and that they would be all very much part of 1916. That's very important. So it's the commemoration of the people who participated, the leaders who were executed, and also the involvement of the families of all the people, including those who were shot too on the British side, which were mostly Irish people. And there were a number of English people fighting on the Irish side, which a lot of people don't realise either. So just really to understand exactly what happened, and also to understand the people who were involved. And the proclamation, for example, it was about equality, and equality of people, and there was an equality referendum in Ireland recently about same-sex marriage, but that was what these people in 1916 were talking about. It was equality for everybody. And also, there were principled people in the proclamation. It was clearly stated that anyone who was fighting in the name of Ireland would do it, I suppose, humanely, and also have regard for their adversaries in battle, which they demonstrated when they took over the GPO. They took people hostages, but they made sure to feed them and look after them very well as well. So they were quite principled, these people. They weren't into kind of terrorist activities that happened afterwards. It was a kind of a stand-up battle where they were waiting for the British forces to come and attack them. So it's all of this must be analysed, and then it was very driven by poets, and they were highly educated people, and the poetry of 1916 would reflect that. And of course then the Irish language played a major role, because they connected mostly through the Gaelic League, and that's where most of the IRB recruitment went on, through members of the Gaelic League. If people joined the Gaelic League, then they were sworn into the Irish Republican Brotherhood. So there's huge interest there that must be explored. And then New York, of course, played a critical role, because John Dubois had a major influence on Casement. It was John Dubois who influenced Casement to go to Germany to set up an Irish brigade of the prisoners of war that were taken in World War One. So he went to Germany to do that, to try to get some of those to come back and fight against the English in Ireland. They fought for them in the World War One, and also to get arms from the German government. That really, I suppose, if the German government had been strategic, would have supported maybe the volunteers more from the point of view of arming them and even sending military personnel, which they sought for, and even a submarine to stop any British battleships coming in, like the Helga coming in to bomb the positions in Dublin. So the German governments had embraced, I suppose, what Casement was trying to do under the direction of Dubai. It could have been a more difficult battle for the British at the time to overcome. Also, Joe McGarity, he was from Pennsylvania, he was from Philadelphia. He was very much involved as well, both him and Dubai, and some of the finance to buy arms came from New York. And O'Rahilly, the O'Rahilly, who was from Ballylongford, actually spent some time here in New York, and his wife's family had an apartment not far from here. And she was brown, and they were in Philadelphia, and then they came to live in New York. So he spent some of his very formative period here in New York. So he had that huge connection with New York as well. Then you had Thomas Clark, he had a huge connection here with New York, and others of the leaders too had a huge connection with New York, including James Connolly. So America played a big role, and the only country that's mentioned in the proclamation is America.
Well, you'll be glad to hear, Minister, we have a full robust programme really trying to interrogate the role of Irish America and particularly Irish New York. We've some great research projects being undertaken right now, which will culminate in next April in a major symposium.
Well, then,
so I know you'll be very interested and engaged with that.
And we're doing a whole project now on a website, Inspiring Ireland, and any of your listeners there, I would suggest that they would Google it and go to that site. We established it just 2 years ago. I established it with a woman called Sandra Collins from the Digital Repository in Ireland, who is now actually the new director of the National Library, and a girl called Colleen Dubay, who was working with Fulbright in Dublin at that time, and the Fulbright scholarships. And so it's the place really to go to if you want information on Ireland, and that's the way it's going to be in the future. So our next big project is on 1916. So we want to put all the information that's available on that site. It's the Irish government site. The cultural institutions of Ireland are combining together to put all the information they have on 1916 on this site. So no matter where you are in any part of the world, if you want to get information, original sources, video clips of what happened at the time, we're trying to put it all on this site so people, they'll get it all. And that's why what you're doing here, we'd love to have some of your information as well to go on that site.
Well, let's hope that we you're back again soon, Minister, so we can continue this conversation both on air and off air. And thank you very much, Gurv Míle Mahagut. It's been a real honour to sit down and chat to you today.
Well, thank you very much, and looking forward to coming back.
Thank you. Luxman Ireland House, the Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies at New York University. We're very busy preparing for and very excited about the next 9 months as we look to the centenary of 1916. And here at Luxman Ireland House, we anticipate major excavation of the role of America in the Easter Rising.
We have now got, I think, an established scholarly base in publication terms, in conference terms, in seminar terms. And I want us to be able to continue to do them and to improve further in doing them to the very highest level.
The program at Glaxman Ireland House, beginning this September, will give all of us a chance to not only learn about those involved in the rising of 1916 in Ireland, but more specifically, to learn about the Americans who were involved in these important events.
The public programming will culminate in a major symposium in April 2016, which will gather together very world-renowned and accomplished scholars who will explore what exactly went on here in places like New York and in other parts of the United States, which contributed to what we know of the Easter Rising today.
My father was Ernie O'Malley, who was involved in the Easter Monday Rising of 1916. Father at that time was a 19-year-old first-year medical student. And on that Monday, walking down Sackville Street, he read on the Proclamation of Independence words which changed his life. And they were that Ireland should be for the Irish.
The Easter 1916 Proclamation includes a line that says, supported by her exiled children in America, our mandate for the centennial of the Easter 1916 Rising is to unpack that sentiment. Who and what were the exiled children in America?
Many people in Ireland will recognize the name of Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa. Of course, they associate him with his burial in Glasnevin on August 1st of 1915. Pádraic Pearse gave a famous oration over his grave. He died on Staten Island in New York on June 29th of 1915. Rasa came to the United States in late January of 1871, and for nearly 50 years, he was easily among the most famous Irish-American activists. He was involved in local politics as well as nationalist politics.
What's in the air in the run-up to Easter 1916 is the concept of a republic, that independence for Ireland means a republic, not home rule. But suffice it to say that in 1916, New York is the epicenter of Irish nationalism, be it constitutional or militant.
Rasa never reconciled himself to the constitutional process. He truly was an unrepentant Fenian. He died in 1915, which is significant for many reasons. Arguably, the Easter Rising would not have happened without that oration. Tom Clark, who was in Ireland at the time, but who had been in New York, Tom Clark sent a telegram to De Foy after Ross's death and said simply, send him home. The fact is that Clark understood the propaganda value of having Ross's body in Ireland at a time when things were ramping up for a rebellion.
And so it is fitting that after 100 years from 1916, we here celebrate the impact of what America gave to Ireland in terms of ideas, funds, guns, not only for the immediate cause of the initial 1916 revolution, but of the later fulfillment of the dream of a more open society. Ireland can now celebrate its accomplishments 100 years later, and we at Glucksman Ireland House welcome the opportunity to remind our fellow Americans and the Irish of what a role America played in its history.
So come visit us, you'll be very welcome.
Coming towards the end of the program, I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM and on HD Radio in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my wonderful producer, Jamie Sweeney, please do email us at ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour. Our theme music today is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Stay tuned for The Adrian Sonnelly Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Thanks for tuning in for another week of the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus bunach.